There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect. We're here to speak the truth on the real issues of the day in real time. So, how do we do that? How do we get God back into the conversations of the day? How do we get God back into the conversation related to Charlottesville and now related to things taking place across the country in reaction and response to Charlottesville? How do we enter into conversations as ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? Let's face it, people don't need just another piece of our mind, another opinion piece, but they do very much, and I would say even increasingly right now in our culture, need the very peace of the mind of Christ. He's the Prince of Peace. You are his representative in the world. What are you saying in the conversations of the day? If you want some help with that, we'd invite you to connect. I'd invite you to connect with me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're there, you can sign up for our email newsletter. You can also like The Reconnect on Facebook, and you can let me know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter at Carmen LaBurge. All right, friends, most of you are not, you're not watching the TikTok of what's happening out there every single second in the culture. And so you may not be aware that today there's all kinds of stuff continuing to go on in relationship to response and reaction to protests in relationship to the events that took place in Charlottesville, Virginia, over the weekend. And so right now in Nashville, Tennessee, there are protests at the Capitol building in New York City. There are protests in front of the American History Museum I'm holding in my hand information about what took place in North Carolina. This is currently the lead on Fox News. Criminal charges sought for protesters who toppled Confederate statue in North Carolina. When protesters, angry over the deadly incidents in Virginia this weekend, decided to take down a nearly century-old statue of a Confederate soldier in North Carolina on Monday, law enforcement stood back and watched. At no time did officers with the Durham Police Department or deputies with the Durham County Sheriff's Office intervene as activists brought a ladder up to the statue and used a rope. It was actually, for any of you who like know how to strap something to the back of a truck, that's really what they did. They used one of those, straps that you strap stuff down with in the back of your truck, one of those like woven nylon straps. They put the grappling hook kind of thing around it and they just pulled it down with a truck. No one was arrested on Monday. However, a day later, Durham County Sheriff Mike Andrews announced that investigators were working to identify the protesters and planned to bring criminal charges against them. Notably, the Confederate Soldiers Monument in Durham is not one of these like mid-century installments. Like, this is not one of those that went up sort of in the lead up to the civil rights era, where in a lot of places in the South, communities erected monuments as if they were celebrations of history, when in fact they were pretty racially motivated statements even at the time in the 50s and 60s. This particular Confederate Soldiers Monument in Durham was dedicated in 1924. It shows a soldier holding a rifle, and when it came down, a diverse crowd is described here as cheering. Some of them began kicking the crumpled bronze monument. It's notable that this toppled soldier stood on a pedestal that was inscribed with just a handful of words, "In memory of the boys who wore the gray." And so we're talking here about violence. We're talking about taking to violence. We're talking about taking to vandalism. We're talking about taking out your anger on the memory of other young people in this country who lived in a different time and under different circumstances, and certainly at that point with a different worldview. And so this is going to be an ongoing conversation, as this is not the only place in the country where these kinds of things are happening. There's going to be all kinds of conversations about law enforcement, when they should intervene, how they should intervene, whether or not these monuments should be should continue to stand where they now stand, or whether or not they should be removed to some other location. Here's part of the challenge. Even monuments that currently exist in what you and I would recognize as museums, which is the circumstance of the Theodore Roosevelt statue in a museum in New York City that protesters are demanding be taken out and removed. We are talking here not just about taking monuments down in public places. We're talking about actually removing them in some cases from museums, where, you know, that's sort of where you go to remember the history. And here's the thing, we ought not forget our history. As bad as it is on this particular front, we ought not forget our history lest we be doomed to repeat it. And some people are saying, well, it's being repeated in some ways even now. So I'm going to read you a text message that I just received from a listener. She says, or he says, I'm a Southerner who has Confederate soldiers in my family lineage. I'm wondering if taking down all the statues will fix the problem. This is a heart problem. I don't think statues up or down are going to keep the white supremacists away or the other side happy. Was it a vocal minority of people in Charlottesville protesting the removal of the legal, which was a legal removal of the Robert E. Lee statue? As bad as those people are, and we don't agree with them, were they just protesting or were they damaging property? Okay, so on and on, people have concerns related to what is described later in this text message as a mob effect. People have concerns about engaging in conversation with people who differ from them. And a lot of people apparently are taking to vandalism and vandalizing our national monuments or vandalizing monuments in general is not a helpful way to go. So this from the National Park Service in Washington, D.C. The National Park Service crews are working now to remove red graffiti from the Lincoln Memorial. It appears someone spray painted expletives on the columns, according to the National Park Service. So, you know, here's the thing. Vandalism, vandalism, destruction of property, physical violence, none of that's okay. Like, there are ways to acknowledge the reality of the evil of racism. There are ways to confront the organization of people around hateful ideologies. There are actually ways of winning hearts and minds, and vandalism and violence is not the answer to either one of those. The gospel is. Part of what I suppose was most disappointing to me in reading the follow-up coverage to what happened in Charlottesville is actually the fact that there were a lot of pastors involved in the protest of the event. So what was going on was this demonstration, I suppose. Well, I guess the initial thing actually was a protest. It was a protest that the Robert E. Lee statue was going to be removed. And so then there is a counter protest. And there were lots of pastors involved in that counter protest. If you read their testimonies, if you read what they talk about fear, they talk about hate, and not a single one of them talks about evangelism. Not one person who is quoted in any media outlet that I have read this far, who is a pastor in Charlottesville, who was engaged on Saturday, talks about evangelism, talks about reaching people with the gospel. Instead, they villainize, which is to demonize, which is to make a physical enemy of people who are clearly at enmity with God. I'm not saying that that racist folks aren't at enmity with God. They absolutely are. But that means God wants them. And who has he got in this world to go get them? He's got us. He's got you. He's got me. He's got people who carry the pastor of reverend or pastor around on documents and stand up in pulpits of churches, but who aren't preaching the gospel. So, friends, the gospel is a gospel of love, but it is also a gospel of redemption from sin, which means we got to be preaching a gospel that recognizes sin for what it is and hate as sin for which Jesus died. If this does not become a gospel issue for the left And if they don't understand this as a gospel issue in terms of the actual proclamation of the real gospel, which is a Savior who came from heaven to earth and from earth to the cross and the cross to the grave and the grave to the sky in order that men and women and boys and girls might have the penalty of sin, of death, paid for them, but also might be freed from the power of sin in this life. Because if you want to talk about people who are bound by the power of sin in this life, any sort of racial superiority or claim of racial superiority, that is absolutely spiritual bondage. Nothing could be further from the gospel. All right, Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, who has been a guest on this program and for whom I am particularly appreciative in terms of his comments on this subject. Tim Scott is an African-American. Tim Scott is a fellow brother in Christ. Tim Scott is, he is a precious brother. If you want a friend, Tim Scott will be your friend, man. All right, so anyway, he has an op-ed posted today. And it says, Senator Tim Scott, fight hatred, fear, and domestic terror with American ideals. Now, going into this, you know, I've already told you in advance he's a Christian. So go ahead and recognize he's speaking to America, the American culture, writ large. And so he does not use expressly Christian language. He's calling people to what you and I would recognize as Christian ideals, which he frames as American ideals. Here's the quote that is highlighted in this particular piece. The greatest underappreciated threat we face is the unraveling that occurs from the inside out. We must counter it with the blunt force of unity. Senator Tim Scott says, there is nothing right about racism and hate. It's a learned disease, and the best antidote is unity. This weekend's events involving white supremacist groups are as disturbing and disgusting as they are heartbreaking. The attack was a stark reminder of the darkness of hate. We must come together, as we have before, to confront the issues that chip away at the very foundation of who we are and what we stand for as a country. Hey, friends, if you're a Christian, then when you hear somebody talking about chipping away at the foundation, you know the erosive power of undermining the foundation. Like, you know when somebody erodes away, when somebody undermines the foundation of the church, which is the gospel of Jesus Christ, when somebody undermines the word of God and the life of the church, you know the erosive power that has. That's what Tim Scott's talking about here. We cannot allow the erosive power of racism to actually undermine the foundations of who we are as one people, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. He goes on later in this piece to say, am I angry that racism exists in this country I love so dearly? Absolutely. But I know that it is not indicative of the vast majority of Americans. Overwhelmingly, we believe in the words, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Those are the same words we read yesterday. Those are the same words that the President of the United States alluded to in his comments and remarks related to the condemnation of the alt-right, the condemnation of white supremacists, the condemnation of those involved in the KKK. Tim Scott goes on to say, I also know that our best chance to defeat racism is in continually expressing our most American of ideals, that we are one nation made of many peoples, that we are one nation under God. As Martin Luther King Jr. said, we must all learn to live together as brothers or we will all perish together as fools. Senator Tim Scott says this, I encourage us all to reach out to those who may hold a different viewpoint and extend a hand. A good friend and colleague, Senator James Lankford, Republican of Oklahoma, and I launched an initiative called Solution Sunday, which if you just Google Solution Sunday, this will pop up, to help get folks from different walks of life to sit down for a meal and get to know one another. Now, friends, the reason they call it Solution Sunday is because both of these men go to church, and they also know that people who go to church do what after they go to church? They go to lunch. So there you go. So this particular coming Sunday is a Sunday upon which we're going to encourage you to reach across the proverbial aisle, whatever that looks like. It may actually be the aisle in the center of your church. It may be the train tracks that still separate people in your town. It may be some sort of racial division that you experience. It might be a socioeconomic division. It may be time to take a single mom out to lunch with her kids. I don't know who it is that lives on the proverbial other side of the aisle from you, but it's time to take them out to lunch. So there you go. On Sunday, I'm going to expect you to do your part in bridging the divisions in the United States of America by actually demonstrating what unity looks like. The unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace we enjoy in Jesus Christ actually does bring down every dividing wall of hostility between us. That's the promise of the gospel. If we're not experiencing it in our lives, then we need more Jesus. All right, so Russell Moore, who is the president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Church, had the opportunity not only to post a perspective piece in the Washington Post, but then subsequently be interviewed about that on CNN. So I'm going to let Jake Tapper, I'm going to let you listen to a portion of the conversation between Jake Tapper and Russell Moore on CNN, and then we'll talk about it.
Dr. Moore, let me ask you, you wrote a Washington Post op-ed today, and you wrote, quote, "White supremacy is Satanism. Even worse, white supremacy is a devil worship that often pretends that it is speaking for God. White supremacy angers Jesus of Nazareth." Very, very strong words, sir. Do you see a disconnect between President Trump and what we hear is his heart, and for whatever reason is his ability to swiftly condemn white supremacists?
Well, I don't know about the reactions of the political leaders, and I will leave that to the political class to sort that through. What I'm primarily concerned about is American culture. It's about the American church. Are we speaking clearly, especially when we look around the world and we see this resurgence of anti-Semitism and racism and bigotry? We have to be the people who understand history doesn't just take care of this on its own. We have to be the people who guard what it means for everyone to be created in the image of God and to bear the dignity of human beings. And that's why churches are mobilizing in Charlottesville and everywhere else to say we can't assume just because we're in 2017 that somehow we've left the American legacy of bigotry and racism behind. That's what concerns me very much.
Okay, so in response to Charlottesville over the weekend and in response to everything that you've heard since then, what concerns you very much? Because when Russell Moore says Jesus Christ is angry about white supremacy, when he talks about this issue being a gospel issue, do you understand it that way? Do you see it that way? And when he says that, hey, we the people have to actually get out there and confront this. We the people have to actually change this in our culture. It's not as if just time, sands over time, water under the bridge. It's not as if time is actually going to heal the wounds of racism in our culture. They're obviously still there. This is obviously not something that we have outgrown. It's not something that we have overcome. This is a reality that we are living in 2017. And so we talked about this yesterday. I would encourage you to go and get yesterday's podcast at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Because I talked yesterday about the reality that for Christians, I mean, what we have to recognize is the equal footing that every human being shares at creation, as image bearers of God, at the cross, as sinners in need of salvation to whom grace is offered in Jesus Christ, and in the kingdom. There's equal footing in all of those places. Those are the places where we stand on equal footing with everyone else. And so if you're a Christ follower, if you're a person who says, I'm not only saved by Christ, I'm saved for his use in the world today, then you are his ambassador, and it's your job. It's your job to be a part of we the people who are out there in the culture today actively confronting this particular issue. Russell Moore's conversation with Jake Tapper concluded this way.
When you look at all the hate that was on the streets of Charlottesville, Virginia, on Friday night and on Saturday, and you're a religious leader and you're somebody for whom racial reconciliation is an important issue, do you find it problematic? Let's remove President Trump from the equation. Do you find it problematic when people act as if the Klan and the Nazis are morally equivalent with the counter-protesters.
There is no moral equivalence at all between the Klan and these neo-Nazis and others and the counter-protesters. We need more counter-protesting of this sort of hatred and bigotry, and I don't think we can just ignore it and assume that it will go away. I think that ignoring this kind of thing is what led to the sort of tragedy and hatred that we saw so often in the 20th century. We can't ignore it. We have to speak up, and we have to also be the people who are teaching our children what's happening when it is at the small level of protest marches and so forth, to say this is not who we are as Americans, and this is not who we should be as for those of us who are Christians, as followers of Jesus Christ. I don't think we can ignore that. I think we have to speak very, very clearly and in clear moral categories about these things.
Okay, speaking in clear moral categories and recognizing that one of the words that's being used a lot is the term Nazi and the term neo-Nazi and then the term alt-right. And you may not be really terribly familiar with the term alt-right, but my guess is you're very familiar with the term Nazi. Here's the challenge that we face today. There is neo-Nazi propaganda. When Russell Moore talks about the need to teach our children, somebody is speaking into the life of your child today. Somebody is speaking into the life of your grandchildren. Somebody is speaking into the lives of the kids in your church. If you are not actively speaking into their lives on this particular subject, someone else is. And two very loud competing extremes are screaming into their lives today. And so you have to decide, is my kid going to be influenced by the alt-right or the Antifa? Or they're going to be influenced by me and the gospel? I'm going to encourage you to engage your kid on this issue. Do not let this conversation, this moment in time, this moment of truth, pass you by without the opportunity to converse. And you say, well, I need a starting point. I need some way of talking with my kids about what the Nazis did and who they are. I got something for you. Here's an easy, easy hook. Remember, we're always looking for an angle. We're fishers of men. We're looking for the angle in the conversation with each and every person. We talked some time ago in a Below the Fold about a 112-year-old Auschwitz survivor who finally got to have his bar mitzvah because he didn't get bar mitzvahed when he was 13, as is the custom among Jews. So that gentleman, Israel Kristal, has now died. The Auschwitz survivor, who was the world's oldest man, died in Israel at the age of 113. He was the only member of his family to survive the war. And he was described on Saturday, August the 12th, in this Associated Press piece by his grandson. All right, there's a couple of things I want to tell you about him. And then I want to have you tell your kids, not just about him, but about why his life was the way that it was. So he was orphaned in Poland after the First World War. And when the Nazis invaded Poland in what we call World War II, his two daughters died in the ghetto and his wife died in Auschwitz. He was the only member of his family that survived the Holocaust. He later married another Holocaust survivor. Oh, I should tell you. He weighed 81 pounds on the day that Auschwitz was liberated. 81 pounds. He later married another Holocaust survivor. They moved to Israel in 1950. He built a new family and a successful business. These are some quotes by his grandson, Oren. He was a very hardworking man with a lot of energy, and he was always running from place to place. And when asked why he was running, he said, well, my grandfather always said, you must walk fast, because if you don't walk fast enough, your feet, and he meant bare feet, will stick to the frozen ground. This was a man who knew the hardness of life. This was the man who knew the torture of the Nazis. Oren said of his grandfather that his grandfather participated recently in his grandson's bar mitzvah just a few weeks ago, and that as an observant Jew, Kristol himself only celebrated his own bar mitzvah last year, 100 years later than usual. He missed his bar mitzvah because of World War I. Friends, when you are speaking into the lives of your children on this issue, you have to introduce them to the Nazis of World War II, or they will never understand why we must stand today against the neo-Nazis of our generation. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. You can connect with me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com or on Facebook at The Reconnect or on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBerge. When we come back, we're going to be talking about issues of life and eugenics. This is The Reconnect. We'll be right back. Hey friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect. You can connect with me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're at the website, you can sign up for our email list. You'll receive timely equipping resources that are designed to help you reconnect the eternal with the everyday and bring God back into conversations in ways that honor Jesus. So again, the website is reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can find all my social media links there, but you can go ahead and like The Reconnect on Facebook, and you can always let me know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter at Carmen LaBurge. We're going to talk here in just a moment with Amy Julia Becker. Amy Julia is working now on a book tentatively titled White Picket Fences, Confessions of Privilege. She's also the author of Small Talk, Learning from My Children About What Matters Most. But I am having a conversation with her today in part because of what she talks about in a book entitled A Good and Perfect Gift, Faith, Expectations, and a Little Girl Named Penny. Now, let me just go ahead and tell you that Penny was born with Down syndrome. I want you to know that as I read to you a portion of this news article from CBS News. So this CBS News piece is entitled, "What Kind of Society Do You Want to Live In? Inside the Country Where Down Syndrome is Disappearing." Here's the lead. With the rise of prenatal screening tests across Europe and the United States, the number of babies born with Down syndrome has significantly decreased. But few countries have come as close to eradicating Down syndrome births as Iceland. Now, part of the reason that I'm reading this article to you is so you can hear the tone in which it sounds as if CBS News is celebrating the eradication of Down syndrome. Let's keep in mind that it's not Down syndrome that they're eradicating. It's people who have Down syndrome. Okay, so it goes on. It says, since prenatal screening tests were introduced in Iceland in the early 2000s, the vast majority of women, close to 100%, who received a positive test for Down syndrome terminated their pregnancy. So they, if they get a positive result for Down syndrome, nearly 100% of prospective mothers then terminate their pregnancies. So much so that we're talking about something like less than a half a dozen Down syndrome people born with Down syndrome in Iceland in any given year. The article then goes on to say, and again, it sounds as if they are celebrating the what they call Down syndrome termination rates. It says other countries aren't lagging too far behind in Down syndrome termination rates. According to the most recent data available, the United States has an estimated termination rate for Down syndrome of 67%. I don't know about you, but the way that they go about the way that they're talking about this this issue is as if these are not people. And so let me read this paragraph, and then we're going to start our conversation with Amy Julia Becker and get her take on this as a mom. So there is a person who is one of six people born with Down syndrome just a handful of years ago. She's now 7 years old. Her name is Augusta. She is the third child of her parents, and her mother became an activist for the rights of people with Down syndrome after she was born. As Augusta grows up, her mother says, "I hope that she will be fully integrated on her own terms in this society. That's my dream. Isn't that the basic need of life? What kind of society do you want to live in?" And so with that question and that quote, let me welcome again to the Reconnect Amy Julia Becker. Amy Julia, I know that this is a heartbreaking article for you to be exposed to, but this is a reality with which you live every day, and I want to invite you to speak into the lives of our listeners on this subject. So welcome to the Reconnect.
Thanks for having me, Carmen. It's great to be here.
Okay, so let's just give me your gut-level reaction to what's going on in Iceland and the way CBS News is reporting on it.
You know, it's interesting because I think I have a pretty thick skin now that my daughter Penny is 11 when it comes to reporting like this. And so I tend to say, yep, that's how things are going. And I don't mean that in a callous way at all, but just that this has, with the rise of prenatal screening tests, the rise of, you know, people who have chosen to terminate pregnancies with Down syndrome has also gone up in Europe especially, and also in the United States. And I just have been really aware of that over the past 11 years of having Penny in my life. So I don't feel very shocked anymore when I read things like this. I was actually grateful that CBS included this mother and child and a picture of Augusta. I thought they, some news reports are actually, believe it or not, far more positive about the idea that people with Down syndrome might cease to be among us than this one was. So this, to me, in the grand scheme of people who are reporting on these topics, they did a better job than some, because they at least represented a person with Down syndrome, gave a picture of us, and we can see that she is a happy and healthy little girl. And so there was more positive here than I often see, believe it or not. That said, of course, it is really sad for anyone who knows and loves a person with Down syndrome to think of the attitude and the misinformation that I think people carry in making decision after decision to end these lives in the womb.
So, Amy Julia, tell us what the world would be missing if Penny wasn't in it.
You know, for the world would be missing a delightful 11-year-old girl who loves weddings and gymnastics and who is not particularly interested in princesses, someone who is really just tender-hearted and kind, who rushes to comfort people or to write a note of condolence if she hears that something has sad has happened in someone's life, and also someone who can be a very annoying big sister to her brother and little sister, someone who can, you know, certainly faces challenges medically and cognitively, but who also loves to read, who has good friends, who went to sleepaway camp, who plays the piano. I mean, I could just go on and on and on, and much of what I would say would sound like, you know, just me describing my daughter, who has some particular gifts and some particular challenges, and who also happens to have Down syndrome.
So one of the quotes in this piece that I think I found particularly troubling is this notion that that prenatal counselors counsel women who might be struggling with a decision and feeling guilty about the prospect of terminating their child's life, saying to them things like, and this is the quote from the piece, "This is your life. You have the right to choose how your life will look." Every single child, you know this because you have more than one, every single child is a quote-unquote burden of sorts. Mm-hmm. So how can we advocate effectively in a culture that sees some people and some children as a greater burden than other people and other children?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. One that comes to mind is exactly that, a greater recognition that what it means to be alive, if you want to put it in these terms, is to be a burden. That is, we all burden one another. But what the flip side of that is to be someone in relationships that are vulnerable and loving with other people, right? Like that is what we do to one another. We depend on one another. We need one another. And that is what love is all about. And so it's a strange thing when love gets turned into a burden. And I think you're right that quotation, "This is your life, you have the right to choose how your life will look," I mean, it's not even true, because none of us know what we're choosing when we are choosing to have a baby. We have no idea the characteristics and experiences and health issues that will or won't come up with any child, and that is certainly true with a child with Down syndrome as well. So it's a false statement, first of all, but certainly countering the idea that life ever comes without what they're calling burden, but then countering it with the idea that what makes our lives worth living is that we are quote-unquote burdens to one another, because that means that we have to love each other, have to give of ourselves, have to need and depend upon one another. And that's actually really beautiful if we can approach it with a pretty different perspective in mind.
All right, so as we move forward in this conversation as a culture, and prenatal screening becomes more and more, you know, not just available, but probably prevalent in use, can you just speak for a moment to, you know, pregnant women or women who may become pregnant in the future, about that decision that is in front of them? How to respond, no matter what the outcome is of a test, maybe some encouragement of how to respond.
Yeah, so I think there are two things I would advise women. One is to really think ahead of getting a test about what that information, what you want out of that test. What is the information that you want, and why do you want it? Because I think that often women take these tests because it's a simple blood test and the doctor says it's not going to cause any harm to you or your child. So you say, okay, sure, I'll take this test. So I think it's really important to consider, what is the information that I'm getting, and how would that help or harm my relationship with this baby? But secondly, for the women who do take that test and have a prenatal diagnosis or indication of Down syndrome, I think what often happens is there's already love for that baby. Many of these women have wanted these pregnancies and already feel a sense of excitement and joy. So there's already love for that baby that's established there. But what happens is, with that diagnosis, fear comes in and starts to fight with that love. And one of the things that I've realized, not only in my own life, but in looking at countless other parents with children and siblings who have Down syndrome, is that the fear is not what wins over the course of a child with Down syndrome's life. The love is what wins. But it's very hard as a parent when you have not met this child, you have lots of negative stereotypes perhaps about that whole population of people, and often have some social pressure, whether that's from friends and family or from doctors, or even just implicit bias that is throughout your culture, that says this is not going to be a good life. What I would really say to women is that love is stronger than fear, and it will win out. And that's the thing. I was so afraid when Penny was born and she was diagnosed with Down syndrome, and there are still times when I face fear over her future, but I am more and more confident as she grows up that our love for her and her love for people and God's love for her, that is what is triumphing in her life, and it's really beautiful to see, and it's such an honor. It is such a privilege to be able to bear witness to that, to be her mom, to know her as the sweet and beautiful child that she is, and to get to watch her grow up into a young adult and eventually a young woman, and see that she continues time and again, love is what wins out in her life and in our family, in part because of having her as a member of it. So I would counsel any woman who is facing that type of fear to look for ways in which love can conquer that fear, because I really believe that that is what happens and what can happen in life, and especially in the lives of children with Down syndrome.
Amy Julia Becker, thank you so much. Friends, this is not the only area of life in which Amy Julia is helping us understand how love conquers fear. She's also working on a book right now, tentatively titled White Picket Fences, Confessions of Privilege. She's the author of Small Talk, Learning from My Children About What Matters Most, and the book we talked a little bit about today, A Good and Perfect Gift, Faith, Expectations, and a Little Girl Named Penny, which was named one of the top books of 2011 by Publishers Weekly. You can follow her, what she's writing about, and where she's speaking at amyjuliabecker.com. Amy Julia, thank you for being with us today on The Reconnect.
Thanks for having me, Carmen.
All right, friends, the article about Iceland ends this way. And the reason that I'm going to share this with you is it's a segue into a conversation about what kind of society we want to live in here in America. So there's a geneticist that is quoted here. This geneticist gives counsel to women at the, I won't even try to name, a university hospital in a town in Iceland that I can't pronounce. But she is a doctor who gives counsel to women making these decisions, the kinds of decisions that Amy Julia and I were just discussing. She says this: in America, I think some people would be confused about people calling this our child, saying a prayer or saying goodbye or having a priest come in, because to them, abortion is murder. She then went on to say, well, actually, that was what was said to her. She went on to say, we don't look at abortion as murder. We look at it as a thing that we ended. We ended a possible life that may have had a huge complication, preventing suffering for the child and for the family. And I think that is more right than seeing it as murder. That's so black and white. Life isn't black and white. Life is gray. Okay, well, life is only gray if you have the opportunity to actually live it. It's pretty black and white if somebody terminates your life before it even has the opportunity to begin. So where does this kind of thinking come from? This kind of thinking that says that is not a human being, that is not a life, and for either my convenience or so that I will not be unduly burdened in the future, I have the right to terminate the life of the child within me. I can tell you where this idea comes from, and I can also tell you that it is prevalent in the culture in which you and I live here in the United States of America. This goes back to the whole idea that ideas have consequences. The practical outcome of a philosophy that says that human beings can define not only our own moral parameters, because we are our own moral authority, but we can actually then determine the moral value of another person. That's what's going on here. So this notion that that we can determine the value of another person it results in not only abortion, but ultimately infanticide. And there are philosophical ideas that undergird all of this. And you say to yourself, but that is fringe thinking. These aren't, the idea that I have moral authority over another person and that I can determine whether or not they live or die inside the womb or even outside the womb to a certain age, surely that's fringe thinking, and it's not something being taught here in the United States of America. Well, you would be wrong. This is actually what is being actively taught at elite U.S. universities. This is what forms the thinking of the next generation of America's leaders. There's a professor of philosophy at Princeton University who actually explained the morality of abortion in a recent interview on a podcast entitled Philosophy Times with James Franco. Here is what she said in part. Maybe I've got a clip there that says talks about abortion.
In some of my work, I defend a liberal position about early abortion. So I defend the view that there's nothing morally bad about early abortion. So a lot of people think, well, it's permissible to have an abortion, but something bad happens when the fetus dies. And I think if a fetus hasn't ever been conscious, it hasn't ever had any experiences, and we abort it at that stage, that actually nothing morally bad happens. And this view might seem unattractive because it might seem that it dictates a cold attitude towards all early fetuses. But what I think is that actually, among early fetuses, there are two very different kinds of beings. So, James, when you were an early fetus, and Elliot, when you were an early fetus, all of us, I think that we already did have moral status then, but we had moral status in virtue of our futures, in virtue of the fact that we were the beginning stages of persons. But some early fetuses will die early in pregnancy, either due to abortion or miscarriage. And in my view, that's a very different kind of entity. That's something that doesn't have a future as a person, and it doesn't have moral status.
Okay, people, you heard that. You heard her right. There are two kinds of early fetuses. There are two very different kinds of beings. Different kinds of beings. That is ontological talk, if you are a philosopher. The differentiation of beings is a statement of ontological reality. Ontology is a term philosophers use when they're talking about the nature of being, existence, reality itself. This woman, Professor Harmon, In her ontology, some people are people when they are in the womb, but other people are not people when they are in the womb. They are something other than people. They are some other kind of being. What kind of being, you ask? Well, I have no idea. She's saying that whether or not a person has the opportunity to become a person, therefore gaining moral status in the future, somewhere beyond the womb, is actually 100% dependent on the judgment of the mother. Whether or not you get to be a person is not up to God. It's up to your mom. That's it. It's completely 100% up to your mom. She says to the two people interviewing her, who obviously have moral status because they're alive, she says to those two guys, we had moral status in the womb in virtue of our futures, in virtue of the fact that we were the beginning stages of persons. Then she talks about there being a very different kind of entity, the kind of entity that dies in the womb because of abortion or miscarriage. She says that's something, she doesn't name it because she doesn't have a name for it because it's a person. Anyway, she says that something doesn't have a future as a person, and it doesn't have moral status. So just to be clear, according to Professor Harmon, a person only has moral status if that person has a future as a person. That what future does a person have who's born with a very low IQ? These are questions that I have for you. When you think about this notion that a person only has moral status if that person has a future as a person, what kind of future does a person with a very low IQ have? What future does a person incarcerated for life without the possibility of parole have? What future does a person living in the bondage of sexual slavery or drug addiction have? What future does a quadriplegic have? What future does a person who has outlived their practical usefulness as a productive member of society have? You see that the consequences of this philosophy are not limited to the abortion debate, but to the assessment of the moral value of human life itself. She goes on to say in this interview, quote, So often we do know that if a woman is planning to get an abortion, and we know that abortion is available to her, then we know that that fetus is going to die. In just such a case, she went on to say, it's not something with moral status in my view. So she's saying that I can actually know that a woman is pregnant. I could put my hand on her belly and feel that baby moving around. I could experience that baby responding to external stimuli. I could know there is a life within her, and I could, standing apart from her, know that abortion is available to her, know that she's made a decision to have an abortion, and therefore judge in that moment that the life within her has no moral status. So this is not just something that is inside the mind and the philosophy of the woman who has an abortion. This is something contagious to the people around her. She keeps saying, in my view. I think that's the crux of the matter here. The philosophy being espoused here is purely humanistic, and it's based on a belief that the woman is an autonomous being with complete moral authority. That moral authority extends not only over her own body, but over the body and life of another smaller, weaker, helpless human being. The rights of the woman are not only paramount in this philosophy, they are sole, S-O-L-E. They are preeminent. They are alone. The reason that I bring this up today is because ideas have consequences, and the consequences of naturalism is this kind of syllogism. This is all there is. The system is closed. There is no God. We are the supreme being. This leads, by the way, to racial supremacy as well. We are autonomous. We define what is moral and immoral, good and bad, just and unjust, humane and inhumane. We even define who is and isn't human and the resources that will be allocated to them. Based on what, I ask you? Well, as humanist, it would be based on our assessment of their potential contribution now and in the future. This is the logical consequence of Professor Harman's philosophy of relative moral valuation. All right, friends, I got to tell you, that is not how God sees things. That is anti to the gospel. In God, you are a beloved child, created, redeemed, and called in Christ Jesus. All right, friends, that's literally all we got time for today. Visit me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. I will see you right back here tomorrow on The Reconnect. Have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.